basic sort of features of pseudo-holomorphic curves, and I hope to get to talk about issues of existence and that sort of thing, of these things. Okay, so as I said before, at the end of the last lecture, one of the important, key tools, is that if you have an embedded pseudo-holomorphic submanifold in X, it has a normal bundle, and then there's a normal disk bundle inside, a sub-disk bundle in here, and you can define an exponential map, Q, from N0 into X, which gives you a sort of tubular neighborhood structure with the property that the fibers of Q are pseudo-holomorphic disks. And as a result of that, what that buys you, in a sense, is that you can find sort of locally coordinates Z and W, where Z is the coordinate along sigma, and W is the normal coordinate, and think of these as complex coordinates, such that the 1,0 part of the cotangent bundle of X, near, when you pull it back by the exponential maps, you express it in these coordinates. If you express it in these coordinates, it's the span of, you can write it as the span of, say, we'll call it EZ, which is DZ plus alpha DZ bar, and EW, which is DW plus gamma DZ bar. And alpha and gamma both vanish on sigma, so alpha at W equals 0 is 0, and gamma at W equals 0. And as a result of that, if you have some other pseudo-holomorphic submanifold nearby in the same homology class as sigma, then first of all, it has to intersect each one of these normal disks precisely once, because each intersection is a positive, counts positively, and it intersects at once, so it's automatically the graph of a function of a section of this normal bundle. So sigma prime is automatically the graph of some section eta. And moreover, if it's pseudo-holomorphic, then it's the fact that its tangent space is preserved by J. You can use the fact that to argue that it has to satisfy an equation of the following form. Okay, so in other words, that it satisfies a nonlinear version of the D bar equation. Because of these conditions, we can write gamma. We can write this, if I expand gamma in a power series, just keeping the first term, just writing the linear term, and then there's a remainder. Then the remainder, so the remainder is small. Okay, so so what that buys you is, you see that the linear, to first order, nearby guys are given by the kernel of this sort of normal operator here. So the kernel of an operator D, which is D bar, it's a C linear I mean, an R linear operator, operator, which is a perturbation, a deformation of the usual D bar operator. So that sort of gives you this equation. It allows you, in a sort of very standard way, to construct the local, a local neighborhood of sigma in its moduli space. So remember what the the Riemann-Roch theorem tells you that the index of this operator is equal to the intersection form on sigma . So that's the index, and then in a very completely sort of formal way, you can then argue that a neighborhood of sigma in its moduli space is homeomorphic to F inverse of zero, where F is a smooth map from the kernel of D to the co-kernel of D, with F of 0 equals 0. So, and that's just a completely sort of formal now construction. I mean, given certain Sobolev inequalities for Riemann surfaces and whatever. So that sort of gives you the local neighborhood structure of these things. Now, I want to say also that the compactness, this all sort of basically follows from, the fact that you immediately buy, the positivity of intersections gives you the sort of graph structure. Now, the compactness theorem is also, in a sense, can be seen in a real sense as a consequence of compactness of the positivity of intersection plus the area bound. So let me now talk about the compactness of these moduli spaces, just to give you an idea of how that one might prove that. There are lots of proofs of this, and this is just one version. This version I particularly like because it actually has a sort of local, you can prove a local compactness there. That is, if you have an open set and, say, a proper sequence of proper pseudo-holomorphic submanifolds embedded in this open set with bounded area, you can prove a compactness theorem without knowing anything about the rest of the rest of the submanifold. So it's sort of that's one reason why I particularly like it. But anyway, the point is this: remember that the area of sigma is bounded uniformly. In fact, it's equal to the pairing of omega with, so it's a cohomological or topological thing. And so now if you have a sequence of these guys in the moduli space, then it's a sequence of bounded, area-bounded surfaces, you expect sort of some sort of convergence. And furthermore, you can think of these guys, you can think of these as defining a sequence of currents, that is, linear maps on, let's call this a two-form something else, tau. So tau is a two-form. Because they have bounded area, this is a bounded sequence of currents. So, there's sort of standard convergence theorem. So the limit of these things, these guys have a limit. First of all, as a sequence of currents, you can find a subsequence where the currents converge in a sort of weak topology to some limit current. And furthermore, you can find a subsequence of these guys which converge in the manifold to something which has two-dimensional Hausdorff measure. So you can, in particular, there's a subset C in X, and sigma I, the distance of sigma I, any point in sigma I to C, goes to zero. So, right, this is the sup x in sigma I, distance xc so this converges to zero as I goes to infinity. So that's sort of a fairly standard thing to prove, and actually in this case it's quite easy to prove. And there's a isoparametric, or a sort of kind of isoparametric inequality, which is completely straightforward here, which you can prove is this, that the area of sigma of any pseudo-holomorphic submanifold intersecting a ball of radius r is greater than or equal to some universal constant times r squared times 1 plus O of r. Well, let's keep that out since we're in the fixed manifold. So, I mean, that's quite easy to prove because the area of sigma intersect the ball of radius r is just this integral. And if you're in a small ball, omega, remember their coordinates where omega looks like dx1, dx2, plus dx3, dx4, which is equal to d of 1 half x1 dx2 minus x2 dx3, dx1, plus 1 half x3 dx4 minus 3 and 4 switched thing. And so you can compute this by integration by parts. This is the integral over sigma intersect the boundary of the ball of radius r of 1 half x1 dx2 minus dot dot dot. And so that equality, if you sort of now take absolute values and do sort of obvious things, what you find is that the area in the ball of radius r is less than or equal to, and now I have to get this the right way around, but something like r over 2 times the its derivative, basically, d by dr. And maybe there's a factor of 1 plus some constant times r here that comes from the fact that this isn't really completely Euclidean in this small ball. Anyway, you get an inequality like that, which you can then integrate to get this. If I got the constants right, probably I didn't. But anyway, the bottom line is that just integration by parts gives you this. And so what this tells you is that if you fix a given r, so here's sigma. And let's say we want to cover sigma by balls of radius r with centers. Oh, I should say, assuming the center of this ball, the center lies on sigma. Obviously, that's wrong if sigma misses the ball completely. So, anyway, if you want to cover sigma by balls of radius r such that the balls of radius r over 2 are disjoint, then there are at most n over r squared times some constant. Sorry, there are most 1 over r squared times some constant balls that you need. You can't do with more. There can't be more than these number of balls because otherwise you'd have too much area because each ball has a fixed amount of area. And so how you prove convergence is that if you fix, say, r is equal to 2 to the n, 2 to the minus n, then you have for each sigma I, you have a set of balls b1 up to b, say, n of 2 to the minus n. And there's a factor of I here. And now you see for each n you have a finite, you have a sequence of vectors, and you can take a convergent subsequence that's diagonal for each in. And then this, these balls are, of course, nested, and so you get a sort of limit, which is this set C. So you can kind of construct C completely by hand. You don't actually have to invoke a whole lot of complicated measure theory to do it. Anyway, once you have C, the question is, what kind of structure does it have? Is it pseudo-holomorphic or not? And you can then prove that C has the following form. That C is equal to the union of alpha C alpha. So this is a finite union where C alpha is an irreducible pseudo-holomorphic subvariety. And furthermore, that this current F is given by the integral, the sum over alpha. And then there's some weight M alpha, where M alpha is a positive integer. Okay, so that again isn't terribly hard to do. Well, it gets complicated. Actually, I shouldn't say it's not hard to do, but basically it's, one can do that. So it is actually not easy to do. I wrote at least two versions of it which were not quite accurate, as Richard pointed out. And so it's not totally trivial to do. And actually, I guess Geng Qian pointed out the first version wasn't quite accurate, and I rewrote it, and then Richard pointed out the second version wasn't quite accurate. Presumably the third version is accurate. Anyway. Okay. Right. So let me explain how you would prove that this is... let me just sort of indicate how you prove, how you could prove C was pseudo-holomorphic. So the idea is this: choose a point on C, and well, now the point is we can now, C of course isn't pseudo-holomorphic, but let's take some disk, which is, so we can always find locally lots of pseudo-holomorphic disks the same way, just sort of perturbation theory. So choose some disk, and let's look at, so then we can find coordinates Z and W like we did with those normal coordinates, where the Z is the original pseudo-holomorphic disk and all the constant Z disks are pseudo-holomorphic. So maybe I'll draw this a little bit flatter here. So here's Z, here's W, and here's the origin. And what we know is, since these fiber disks are pseudo-holomorphic, C has to intersect them all positive, or each sigma I has to intersect them with positive intersection. And that tells us that basically C has to intersect it with positive. So each sigma I can't intersect it too many times, because, say, this is not allowed. All right, so let's say the, and of course it can't intersect it infinitely many times, because then it would have too big area. Because if it intersected one of them infinitely many times, it would have to intersect every single one infinitely many times, so it would have, you know, infinite area. So there's only finitely many intersections. Now the fact that there can be more, intersection number can be greater than one, is a major headache, but let's suppose the intersection number is one. So what you find is that C then has basically intersects each one of these disks exactly once. So you're already told that whatever C is the graph, again, graph of a function eta from of Z, eta from Z to W. So we'll call that eta. And then the question is, well, what can you say about this function eta? So right away, the positivity of the intersection tells you that C is locally a graph. Now, if it intersects, if C were to intersect each one of these, say, three times, then it would be a multivalued, basically a graph of a multivalued function. But anyway, let's say it intersects at once, then it's locally a graph, And so right away, and in fact easily seen to be continuous, so right away you sort of have some nice structure. Moreover, you can prove that it's a Lipschitz graph in the following way. You see, the point is this, that if it comes in, say, too steeply here to this point, well, you can choose a point nearby, and now the fact is that it has to intersect each one of these disks, each straight disk once, but you can perturb the pseudo-holomorphic disk, just like you can perturb a complex disk, a holomorphic disk, say z equals 0, which is a holomorphic disk. You can perturb it a little bit by adding sort of higher order polynomials in z. Well, you can perturb this disk, and a little perturbation of it will, so it's pseudo-holomorphic, and a little perturbation, therefore this C must intersect the little perturbation exactly once. Also, and if it comes in too steeply, you can find a perturbation which intersects it twice, and that would be a contradiction. So what you buy here is that immediately you see the thing is Lipschitz. Now, to see it's pseudo-holomorphic, well, that's just a local question at each point, and to prove it's pseudo-holomorphic, you just need to prove that the limit as z goes to 0 exists. That is enough to prove. I mean, if you think about, for example, a function, a holomorphic function, a holomorphic function is characterized by the fact that this limit exists at each point. That's the same as saying it's a holomorphic function. For example, if eta of z, has a z plus a little bit of z bar in it, then what does this limit look like? The limit looks like at 1, z over z is 1, plus epsilon z bar over z, and you see this doesn't have a limit as z goes to 0. And so a holomorphic function is characterized by the fact that this limit exists at each point. Well, given that eta of 0 is 0, you have to always subtract its value. Anyway, so we just have to show the limit exists at each point. So you ask, well, what if this limit doesn't exist? Well, again, if the limit doesn't exist, one can construct a perturbed pseudo-holomorphic disk which intersects the thing too many times, more than once. So that's how you would prove it's pseudo-holomorphic. Now, in the case where the multiplicity is bigger than one, that's sort of the major headache, and that's where I screwed up the argument twice. But anyway, still, presumably, the argument's now right, and one gets what one wants. Okay, so anyway, so that's how you prove the compactness theorem for these things, if you've never seen it done. There are lots of other proofs of compactness. All right, so take a breath of fresh air. Any questions? Okay, what about existence? So how do you prove these things exist? Okay, existence is, of course, a lot of work. And there's two approaches to existence that we have currently. So one is totally serendipity. I mean, it comes from the Seiberg-Witten equations, and there's no moral reason why the powers that be in the world have made this happen. But it turns out that the Seiberg-Witten equations or the Seiberg-Witten story gives existence initially it gives existence of, say, small degree pseudo-holomorphic subvarieties. So, for example, if sigma the class, for example, the basic theorem would be the following. If the second Betti number minus the rank signature, or I guess plus the signature, over 2 is greater than 1, then there exists a pseudo-holomorphic subvariety sigma whose homology class is Poincaré dual to this first Chern class of a canonical bundle. So that's sort of a general existence theorem. And there, you can often, given the nature of the Seiberg-Witten invariance, deduce that there must be other pseudo-holomorphic subvarieties. And depending on, you know, if C1 squared is positive, for instance, you can in fact produce pseudo-holomorphic subvarieties in multiples of the class C1. Okay. By hand. Okay, so that's sort of serendipity. A much more a direct approach is given by Donaldson. So Donaldson has a very different approach to the story. And so Donaldson's approach, in fact, says this, that there exists some... So suppose you take omega as a rational class. Now, by perturbation, I mean, if you have a symplectic form, you can always perturb it to be a rational class. I mean, because if it's symplectic, then adding any small form to it will keep it symplectic, so you can always add a small bit of whatever you need to make it a rational class. So this is no real constraint here on the manifold. So suppose it's a rational class, then there exists some integer n, say positive, it has to be positive, such that and pseudo-holomorphic, well, and symplectic submanifolds sigma with homology class Poincaré dual to n omega for any n. Okay, so that is, if you take a large enough multiple of the symplectic class, it has a symplectic submanifold Poincaré dual to it, and I should point out that this symplectic sigma is pseudo-holomorphic for some J compatible with omega. Okay, so it may not be, if you choose a J, you may not be able to find a class in that for it's a pseudo-holomorphic for that particular J, but in fact it's pseudo-holomorphic for some J. In fact, the J it'll be compatible with will be close in some sense to the original one you chose. So basically up to a bit of a perturbation of J, you will get a pseudo-holomorphic submanifold. I should say here, likewise, This theorem only guarantees it's a subvariety, that is, it may have singularities. If you're willing to perturb the J, then you'll get it to be... So for generic J, it'll actually be a smooth submanifold in that one. Okay, so... So these guys, by the way, have... So for these guys, the moduli space dimension, since sigma is Poincaré dual to C1, the moduli space dimension, the index of this operator is 0. So these guys come in sort of, according to our structure theorem, generically are going to be isolated points in their moduli space. So these are the ones you can count in a nice way without doing anything extra, because generically they'll be finitely many in their moduli space. And if you work through the compactness theorem, generically they'll be discrete, and if you work through the compactness theorem, you'll see generically they'll only be finitely many. So these are the ones you get to count because they're sort of zero-dimensional families. On the other hand, the ones Donaldson finds, the index... Well, it's it's the intersection form applied to the class sigma, so that's n squared, the integral over x, omega wedge omega, minus n times the integral over x, c1 wedge omega. So what you see is that for n, since this is positive for n large, these have very large dimensions. So Donaldson's finding you classes in moduli spaces of very large dimension, whereas this is finding you classes in moduli spaces of very small, of zero dimension. So this existence proof finds you sort of small dimensional classes. That one finds you large. Okay. So what I want to say is a little bit about... So the idea, basically these two existence proof things, I drew that diagram where there's two different things you can do with pseudoholomorphic curves. One, you can count them on the one hand. On the other hand, you can use families to say something about your manifold. Well, these are the ones that are designed for counting, and these are the ones that give you the here you get families. So the existence proofs give you sort of the two, in a way, two different approaches. Although, as I said before, this one you can actually get classes in higher dimensional moduli spaces. So, for example, suppose C1 wedge C1 is positive. Then you can get a class in n times C1 for a slightly perturbed J by just taking n copies of the guy you get from this existence proof, perturbing them a little bit, so you get n distinct ones. Then you have a pseudoholomorphic subvariety because they would intersect. But then you can resolve the intersection points at the expense of perturbing the J a little more. Then you have a smooth subvariety. If this is positive, then it'll move in a family, and so you get a family's worth. So this will give you families, but families in the class multiples of C1, whereas Donaldson gives you families in multiples of the symplectic class. Now, it's sort of an amusing question. In fact, I think it's actually a very important question, is in what cases is C1, can you find a symplectic form in the same class as C1? So this is something that people have solved, Yao and Tian and others have studied on Kähler manifolds. When can you find a symplectic form in the same class as the first Chern class? On a symplectic manifold, this is an interesting unsolved problem as to when can you find a symplectic form in the class of C1. Okay, so let me say a little bit about, first of all, about the Donaldson proof of existence, and then I'll say something, just a few words about the Seiberg-Witten proof. So Donaldson's proof is really amazingly elegant. I mean, if you look at his paper. In fact, this is, you know, it's interesting. You know, one doesn't think of Donaldson, when my initial thought isn't to think of Donaldson as being an analyst, but if you look at his papers, I mean, the analysis is so spectacular. And this paper, which proves existence, is only about 30 pages. It's in JDG. And, you know, looking at the argument, and I think to myself, well, suppose I had thought of this. Well, you know, it's not, you know, the approach is actually, I mean, it's not like some out-of-the-blue approach. I mean, it's an approach you might try. But if I were to write, if I were to have done that, I would think, gee, you know, this would be a paper that, you know, would be probably 150 pages if I had, if I had worked out this approach. Donaldson's paper is 30 pages, and it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's amazing. So, anyway, whatever. So let me describe the approach. So let's suppose just for, you know, by multiplying omega by a fixed integer, we can suppose it's an integral form. So let's just suppose it's an integral form. Okay, so if it's an integral form, then we can think of n times omega as the curvature of a connection on a line bundle L sub n. So we have a complex line bundle raised to the nth power, and we can find a connection on it whose curvature is n times omega. Okay. And so locally, there are, one can find sections of this bundle in, say, we fix a ball in our manifold. Okay, and it has some small radius, radius r. In that ball, we can write omega, remember, as dx1, dx2, plus dx3, dx4. And if we choose, you might say, sort of Gaussian holomorphic coordinates z and w, well, I usually put the z here and the w there. So, you know, z is x1 plus ix2, and w is... Now, of course, these aren't complex for the J, but they're complex to the sort of first order, namely they're dz and dw. So the t10 is spanned here by ez, which would be dz plus o of n dz, and then you'd have an ew. Same thing. Okay, so that, now, so they're sort of holomorphic to first order, and that's basically the best you're going to be able to do. Okay, now let's look at, so we can find over this ball anyway, sections of L to the N, which are, they're not going to be holomorphic. In fact, you're never going to really find a holomorphic section because if the J isn't integrable. But they're pretty close to a holomorphic section, at least for large N. And so typical section, we'll call that S, might be of the form AZ plus BW times E to the minus N Z squared plus W squared. So this section is, of course, it doesn't have compact support in the ball, but out near the edge of the ball, S is pretty small. It's like e to the minus nr squared, or e to the minus nr squared. So it's quite small out near the boundary of the ball. And it's very close to, and it's d of s. Well, d of s is much bigger than d bar. In fact, d of s is greater than something which is o of the square root of n times d bar of s. So it's very much more holomorphic than anti-holomorphic. Okay. Now, if we could sort of find a section with this property everywhere, then it would be a symplectic section. I mean, a zero set would be. So if this were true, if we could find a section where ds is much bigger than d bar s everywhere where s is zero, so if we could find s, a section with, in fact, all you need to be symplectic is just this inequality along S inverse 0, then S inverse 0 is symplectic. Okay, that's just a sort of an exercise in linear algebra, really. And here, well, we found a local section where not only is ds bigger than d bar, but it's like hugely bigger than d bar for large n. Okay, now the problem is that this is just defined locally, and of course the section is getting very small far away, and we don't know how to extend it outside the ball. So what Donaldson says you should do is, well, let's just take a partition of unity. Well, let's just take a partition of unity. We have a bunch of these balls, B sub alpha of R, and we have a partition of unity, psi sub alpha. And we can look at a whole bunch of these sections. So let's look at S as a sum over alpha of psi alpha S alpha. Here, A and B are just constants, say. Complex numbers. Okay, so we choose an A and a B, and then we have a whole bunch of these sections. And this section is going to be, you know, most everywhere, this section will have the property that ds is greater than or equal to O of the square root of n. But, you know, there are going to be places where we can't, where this might not be true. For example, ds is not necessarily going to be large everywhere. So this is true except where ds is nearly zero. Now there we can't really say what's going to happen. Of course, we're only interested in nearby where S is zero anyway. And so what Donaldson then does is has an extremely elegant argument that there's sort of controlled perturbation theory, that if you then sort of choose a generic A and B for each alpha, if you make everything suitably generic, then in fact you get this estimate everywhere where S equals zero, or a slightly worse estimate, but the point is that you get the thing to be symplectic. So it's just an incredibly elegant, you know, controlled perturbation theory, sort of Sard's theorem with control that tells you that you can do that. So that's Donaldson's argument. Now, meanwhile, the Seiberg-Witten argument is, let me say a few words about the Seiberg-Witten argument.
By the way, was this yes. L Kleinmann chosen in any particular way?
Well, its first turn class is the symplectic class, a multiple of the symplectic class. Its first turn class is a multiple of the symplectic form. That's how it's chosen. Okay, that's...
And what is the effect of taking a very high power of that?
Well, you just get a symplectic submanifold that's much... very, very sort of big. It has high genus and winds a whole lot through the manifold. And it comes in a very large dimensional moduli space. Okay, and so just to sort of to finish the story here, the Seiberg Witten side of the story, I'm not going to write down the Seiberg Witten equations because that would be a whole series of lectures on their own. But the Seiberg Witten equations are completely sort of a C infinity category system of elliptic nonlinear equations. And by counting solutions to these equations in a sort of algebraic, relatively creative way, you get an invariant. So they're very natural. They're kind of a version of electromagnetism with a Dirac equation thrown in, and you get an invariant of the smooth structure by counting the solutions. If the equations themselves are canonical once you choose a metric. And given the metric, and then when you change the metric, you're counting the solutions in such a way that the count you get is independent of the metric. And that's sort of where solutions count with pluses and minus signs in an appropriate way. Now, what happens is that it turns out that on a symplectic manifold, you can perturb these equations. You perturb them in a way that doesn't involve the symbol of the equations and doesn't involve the compactness. And you perturb the equations by basically adding to the right-hand side a multiple of the symplectic form, basically. And so when you perturb the equations, you don't change the count, so you still get the same invariant. But in the limit where the perturbation goes to infinity, you see that the solutions concentrate along a two-dimensional subvariety in the manifold. And one can prove that this subvariety is a pseudo-holomorphic. Is exactly the pseudo-holomorphic subvariety that you in the first Chern class with the predicted first Chern class. So that's sort of that's in a nutshell the whole Seiberg-Witten part of the story is that is you take these C infinite equations, you perturb them using this symplectic structure, and as you perturb them, you see the solutions concentrate along the pseudo-holomorphic subvariety. Okay. Okay, so anyway, so you get existence of these things, when you have compactness, you have a basic structure theorem, and all that, then you can then, try to understand, on the one hand, purely symplectic manifolds, on the other hand, see how you could possibly use them to understand smooth four manifolds. Now, in my last lecture, I'm going to explain how these ideas might be, one might try to use the symplectic tools to study manifolds even when you don't have a symplectic structure. But let me end this lecture then by just saying a few words about what we know and don't know about symplectic structures. So the first thing I should say is that we don't know necessary and sufficient conditions for a four-manifold to admit a symplectic structure. Okay, I mean, we know some necessary conditions. I shouldn't say we don't know necessary. There are necessary conditions known, but not sufficient ones. So let me just state some necessary conditions. So the first condition just comes from homotopy theory, is that the first Betti number plus one-half the second Betti number plus the signature of the intersection form must be odd for there to be a symplectic structure. That's the first. Now, where does that come from? Well, a symplectic form is a non-vanishing, nowhere vanishing two-form, which is non-degenerate and compatible with the orientation, and that implies that a certain section of a certain vector bundle is nowhere zero, and you need to say, well, when does this bundle admit nowhere zero section? So that's a homotopy theoretic issue, and the answer is only that bundle admits section nowhere vanishing sections only if this is true. Okay. Okay, so that's where that comes from. And for a long time, that was the only obstruction that people knew existed. And then the Seiberg-Witten equations, and this theorem I just stated about first turn class, gives you some extra conditions. So, for example, if x is equal to y, connect some z, and this combination, let me... The preferred notation for this is to call this B2 plus. And if B2 plus of both y and z are positive, then x has no symplectic forms. Okay, so that sort of rules out symplectic structures on manifolds that decompose as connect sums in a way where both sum ends have B2 plus positive. So, for example, this condition rules out symplectic forms on CP2 connect sum CP2 because it violates this number is even. But this condition doesn't rule out symplectic forms on three sum ends of CP2, but that condition does. So, for example, no number of connect sums of CP2 has a symplectic form except for CP2 itself.
Is B2 plus of y, z, does that mean...
B2 plus of y and B2, it's just being sloppy. I'm just being silly. Okay, so, and then there are some slightly subtler conditions that come from the Seiberg-Witten invariants, which I won't state, which involve the sort of structure of these invariants. But, you know, basically there must be some Seiberg-Witten invariant. Has a value plus or minus one. I mean, that's a condition. And there are some others that get rather subtle, and I won't write them down. But the bottom line is that these conditions are known to be necessary, but they're not sufficient. And to put it in a very direct, to state a very direct open question, which maybe gets to the somewhere to the meat of the argument, although it involves fundamental group, but let's consider a three-manifold M3, so a compact-oriented three-manifold. So we can take X to be S1 cross M3, and we could ask, for what X's does this guy admit a symplectic structure? Okay. So it's known, it's rather easy to construct one, if M3 fibers over the circle, say, so if this is, if it has a fibration over the circle, then in fact X has a symplectic structure. In fact, you can write it down. Omega is dt, where this is the coordinate t is in here, wedge, the pullback of d theta, where theta is the coordinate here, plus some form mu, where mu is positive on the fibers, positive on fibers enclosed. And it's not hard to show, you can always find a form like that. So that's the symplectic form. So now, it may be that X has a symplectic structure if and only if M fibers. We don't know. Okay? That's an open question. So is it the case that X has a symplectic structure if and only if M fibers? So that's the state of the art. I mean, that's where we are. We don't know what manifolds have and haven't symplectic structures. So that's where I'll stop, and what I'll do in my last lecture is outline some sort of speculative approach towards how one might use the symplectic technology to study manifolds even if they don't have symplectic structure. Okay, thank you.
Again in 10 minutes.